Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Metz.
Hello, and thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'm going to put some context around the numbers, perspective around the politics, clarity around the choices facing us in South Africa. Welcome, I'm Jeremy Maggs. Coming up on the program today, Jordan Hill Lewis takes over the DA reins, but can he win black voters and hold the GNU together? He's standing by to talk to me. Medicine prices climb again and patients are asking who really sets the increases. South Africa bets big on gas as it pushes to become Africa's LPG hub. And a trail running boom sparks hope for rural communities, but is it scalable? It's Tuesday, the 14th of April. Now, Jordan Hill Lewis takes over the Democratic Alliance, I think, at a pivotal moment. He says he wants to grow the party beyond its traditional base, close what he calls a trust deficit with black voters, stay in the government of national unity as a principal partner rather than a silent passenger, and build the DA into the country's biggest party by 2029. But the big test, I think, starts now. It starts immediately. Can he broaden the DA's appeal without losing its core? Can he steady a fragile GNU? And will his first leadership moves include changes to the team that John Steenhuisen leaves behind? So lots to talk about. Jordan Hill Lewis, a very warm welcome. Let's go in with the statements that you've made quite emphatically, might I say, about winning black trust. Let me put this to you. Why should black voters believe you now when many still see your party as one that does not fully understand their lived reality?
I think the key difference is that 18 months ago we got the opportunity to have a platform in government at a national level. And so people, particularly black South Africans, can see that the things they've been told and the kind of lies they've been fed for many years about the DA, none of those things are happening. In fact, what is happening is that our ministers are diligently going about fixing institutions that have been broken for many years, and people are seeing actually that they derive personal and community benefit out of that. And so if over the coming years we can continue to do that and even more so, and we can do it in more places, for example, in the city of Johannesburg and Tshwane and Ekurhuleni and elsewhere, then I think many voters can go to the polls saying, well, you know what, I had all these concerns. I heard all of these stories. None of those things have materialized. In fact, all that's happened is I've got to give it to them. They've done quite a good job in fixing things for everyone in government. And I think that will break down the preconceived ideas about the DA and build trust.
Is that enough, though, to turn you into the largest political party by 2029?
Well, the honest answer, Jeremy, is I don't know. I think we have to steadily grow put one foot in front of the other in the right direction. It's certainly not going to be enough to win an outright majority. That, I think, is probably off the cards for the next decade or more, maybe two decades. The South Africa will have coalition governments. But it needs to at least give us a shot of being the biggest party, because then we can really start to turbocharge the rebuilding of South Africa's institutions and get our country working positively for everyone.
The DA still opposes broad-based black economic empowerment. Your challenge, I would suggest to you, is how you persuade black South Africans that you are serious about redress and opportunity and not simply opposed to a model put forward by the ANC.
That is exactly the challenge. The ANC has achieved a very clever sleight of hand by saying if you oppose their model of empowerment, which is essentially crony enrichment and in many cases legalized corruption. If you oppose their model, then you oppose the principle of redress and empowerment altogether. And of course, that is not true, but it's a very clever sleight of hand. And so you've summarized the challenge. We have to show genuinely and in an emotionally resonant way And this is entirely the case that we are profoundly committed to the advancement of South Africans, particularly poor South Africans, and most of whom who are black South Africans. We are deeply invested. That's why we're actually in politics. The whole point of politics, if you're in it for the right reasons, is to see people lifted out of poverty and see human flourishing and development and progress. So we are deeply invested in that, but we are not invested in this current model. And I honestly think there's a growing number of people, perhaps not a majority yet, although some polls will tell you this is the case. There's a growing number of South Africans that say, you know what, all of these politicians who have this enormous unexplained wealth, billionaires and multimillionaires, houses, luxurious palaces all over the place that we don't know where they come from. Well, this is where they come from. So obviously they're not going to change a system that benefits them tremendously. But I do think there's a growing number of people that say actually some major reform of this system is important, is necessary, without compromising or throwing the baby out of the bathwater, that advancement, redress, is absolutely necessary, and we are committed to it.
Let me ask you a question about the Government of National Unity. As you take over the leadership, do you have a red line? What would make the DA walk away from this government setup?
You know, the problem is as soon as you start talking about red lines, then everyone has an incentive to test them. So I'm not so sure that it is healthy to discuss red lines, so openly. But I think a few things are absolutely clear. We said the purpose of the GNU is the first and foremost, it is to keep the destructive and chaotic alternative away from the corridors of power, away from the levers of the state. So, what one red line would be the red berets. I think that's one nice way of summarizing it. We do not want the MK or the EFF to have any access to state power, because they will use it to destroy South Africa and to grossly enrich and plunder public money, as they've done wherever they've had the opportunity to do so, and as they will do now in Gauteng, where they have been brought into the Gauteng government, unbelievably in control of Gauteng's finances. So that is absolutely clear to us. We have very firm policy opposition on other things like NHI and expropriation and so on. But I think that's probably best left to a very tough negotiations and fights inside the GNU.
Well, talking about tough negotiations, are you reviewing the DA ministers and top leadership immediately? And should John Steenhuisen expect to keep your full confidence?
Yes, he should. I mean, he's involved in an epic battle at the moment with foot and mouth disease, and he has set out a plan to try and turn the tables, or turn the tide rather, on that disease. And we are seeing the first signs of that plan starting to work with the rollout of a wide scale vaccination program. He set himself the target of vaccinating 80% of the countries and herd by the end of this year, by December. And I think we have to back him in that plan and see how it goes. But I have made it clear that no person in the DA, in any position, not in my position as mayor, nor in any other position in the DA, should anyone feel entitled to that job. They are there because we have earned the trust of the voters. The voters can remove that trust if we don't perform. And so performance is the key metric by which I will judge anyone. Not by who's friends with who and who's up and who's down. That's not my style. I want people there who are going to perform, who are going to show the DA difference, so that every voter in the country can see, here is a new thing. Here's a breath of fresh air. We can see the benefit we're deriving from having the DA in government.
And just a final question aimed at the business community. It likes stability, but it also wants reform. What do you say today to reassure business that the party under your leadership will be both pro-growth but also politically disciplined?
No, I would reassure them that I am really invested in trying to make the Government of National Unity work. I think it is the best chance that South Africa's had in 25 years to get economic growth and to get people out of poverty. So I don't think that there's anyone, even inside the ANC, who supports the economic reform agenda as much as we do. We are the biggest supporters of the the reform agenda. Of course, we don't think it's going nearly fast enough and far enough. We want much more reform. We want more urgency, faster and harder, basically, is our message. But certainly the direction is right. It is just too timid. And so we really want to make that work for the sake of our country. We know that this is the best chance we have to deliver a growing economy.
And how on earth can you do that while not sitting in cabinet and instead occupying the position of mayor of Cape Town?
Oh, that's actually, I think, a benefit, not a downside, because a mayor is frankly, I mean, you know, just to be honest with you, mayor is a much more influential and powerful position than I would say 90% of most of the ministers in cabinets. You can really get things done. You can really solve problems. You know, out on the campaign trail, most of the complaints you hear from the public are all local government issues. If we get the cities working, they are the engines of growth in our country, and they are what are going to turn around the broken public services in our country. So I love being a mayor, and that's where I want to be. And then secondly, I think it's just healthy politically to give me some distance from the very different dynamic around the cabinet table, so that I can speak freely and speak my mind and agree when necessary and disagree volubly when necessary.
Jordan Hill-Lewis, thank you very much indeed.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
South Africa's pharmaceutical sector is pushing back hard against a controversial medicine price cap, warning it could undermine investment, local manufacturing, and even the long-term security of medicine supply. The industry says the approved increase of just 1.47% is well below inflation, and it's demanding clarity on how that figure was calculated, with some even hinting at legal action. At stake here, as I understand it, that balance, that delicate balance between affordability on the one hand for patients and also the sustainability of the sector itself. Stavros Nicolaou is the pharmaceutical task group chairperson, joins me now to discuss whether this policy risks doing more harm than good. So Stavros, welcome. Let's start with the core issue. This price cap, is it economically irrational in your opinion or politically unavoidable?
Jeremy, I think the first thing for me to start is just to build on something you mentioned earlier. As an industry, we are enormously sensitive to the need to have appropriate and effective access to treatment. And achieving that requires a delicate balance between, on the one hand, having a sustainable industry, an economically sustainable industry, and on the other hand, making your products affordable and accessible to patients who require these drugs. Now, in our opinion, and to answer your question directly, a 1.47% adjustment, which is an annual adjustment, you don't get another one during the year. This 1.47% was granted in January. It's not reflective of the economic realities in the country. For example, in January, prevailing CPI, inflation was sitting at 3.2%. So to get less than 50% of that is not economically rational, and does, in the midst particularly of the geopolitical pressures and stresses that we are seeing and the rising inflationary costs related thereto, this is going to place a further strain on sustainable supply of medicines. But there's another aspect which I want to pick up on, which you've also asked me. What does this mean for future investment in the sector? Now, that's a very difficult thing to respond directly to at this point in time, because no one knows what the Middle East conflict brings in the next couple of weeks. One thing's for certain, however, we need to give our investors certainty and predictability in our country. It's no use having an investment conference that the president hosted 10 or so days ago, but we can't give investors in sectors certainty and predictability. Mm. And certainly a pricing committee that comes out with a 1.47%, which is extremely large, I think you'd be hard-pressed to find anyone that would say the input cost didn't exceed 1.47%. In the absence of that, it becomes very difficult to sell South Africa as an investment destination in the pharma sector.
Let me tell you what I'm interested in, the transparency of the pricing methodology. Do you understand, as an industry, how the number was arrived at?
We actually don't. We've asked the pricing committee, because there are two structures here, and yep. The request has been directed at the Pricing Committee, which is an advisory committee. They advise the minister on this issue. The minister is, of course, not compelled to take their advice, but it seems like on this occasion he did. We've asked on not only this year, but in previous years, for the committee to make a disclosure on how they arrive at these numbers. It's important, A, for planning purposes for the industry, B, for economic sustainability, but also it's important for investors to understand that there's a pricing committee who's taking decisions on a sound economic and scientific rationale, and that's not what we're getting at the moment and have called for same.
Let me put the other case forward to you, if I can. You speak for the pharmaceutical industry. Government might conceivably argue that this is all about affordability and that the sector is simply putting profit ahead of patient access.
Yeah, so I think there's a very simple answer to that, and I don't want to underscore the importance of understanding patient and funder sensitivity at the moment, but very simple explanation on this, Jeremy, is firstly, the health department sets these prices in the first place, and the health department grants an annual increase. So you don't get two or three increases, or you can't set your own increase. So if they come out with 1.5%, that's all you're going to get, right? But the key point here is that these prices are preset. So that means that they would be affordable at the time of being set. Now, when inflation is at 3.2% and you're only granting 1.4%, then you've tilted the balance significantly against manufacturer viability. And that's what we're contending here. We haven't asked for a 7 or an 8 or 9% increase. And many of your listeners on the show will recognize that medical schemes have put up their premiums from anything from 7 to 11%. Now, we know we're close to that. We are merely saying mirror what inflation was in January, which is 3.2%, particularly in the midst of these geopolitical inflationary pressures, which are unquestionably driving up costs. So there's no one in the world that hasn't been affected by these, and the pharma industry sits in that, it's very much in that same inflationary environment.
As a result of this decision, is the sector suggesting that medicine supply in the country is now at risk if this holds?
Well, I think there's always a risk of companies discontinuing products. You know, if products become economically unviable, there's always that risk, and it has happened in the past. But I think what's really compounding the problem, why we've come out at this point in time, and I mean, we still favor dialogue here. But why have we come out at this point in time? Quite simply because events in the Middle East are further driving up what was already an untenable situation in January. And that's why we've come out at this point in time. And hopefully we will be listened to. I happened to be in France last week with the minister at the One Health Summit that President Macron hosted. And I did have a very initial discussion with him. And he's agreed that we pick up on this discussion in the next few days. So hopefully sanity will prevail all round. We can get that balance right. We don't wish to tilt the balance either way. And of course, in midst of all of this are patients. But one of the worst ways to ensure access to treatment is if products become uneconomical, because then you don't get any access at all.
And if sanity doesn't prevail, legal action is a possibility.
I think what we'd like to do is understand how the pricing committee arrived at this 1.47, because you know we've done the maths and we've applied different scenarios and can't get to that point. So I think the legal system does give you it does compel the health department, well, in this instance the pricing committee, to make disclosure and be transparent. And I think that's what we're asking for here is transparency, which we're not getting up until now.
Stavros Nikolaou is the chairperson of the Pharmaceutical Task Group. Appreciate your time. Thank you.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
South Africa, I read, is positioning itself as a potential liquefied petroleum gas gateway to sub-Saharan Africa. But I would also contend that ambition comes with some hard questions around infrastructure, around regulation, supply security, and whether the country can really convert geographic advantage into regional energy leadership. And the big issue here is whether the country is ready to become a reliable hub for cleaner cooking fuel and cross-border LPG trade. I'm going to talk now to Kgadibolaye Dihlabi, who's the Managing Director of the Liquefied Petroleum Gas Association. Kgadibolaye, a very warm welcome, and maybe let's start with the economics. In your opinion then, in the association's opinion, how big is the opportunity in terms of investment, trade and jobs if we get this right?
Good afternoon, Dr. Jeremy and the listeners. How big is an opportunity? I would be lying if I say we have quantified it. But what we know that it is a possibility, it is there. We just have to get our act together as a country in ensuring that our infrastructure is ready or is available and ready to take this opportunity and move it forward.
Let's talk in just a moment about getting our act together. But South Africa may be well positioned geographically, but explain to me what advantages we have that make hub status credible.
So already South Africa exports LPG to our neighboring country. I think we export roughly 180 to 200 metric tons, 1,000 metric tons of LPG to our neighboring country. So we are not new to actually using our ports, our export channels to send product away. But can we scale it up? I guess that is a question. Because in Africa, the rest of Africa, LPG is growing and the demand is growing, which means South Africa needs to be ready to meet that demand. And I believe our infrastructure is well on the way into meeting that.
If we're going to scale things up, you're absolutely right. We've got to get the infrastructure right. Are there still infrastructure gaps that stand between ambition and reality, even though you say we are on a better or more solid footing?
Yes, there are some developments in the infrastructure, but there are also those impediments. As you know, our refining capacity has declined considerably. We are now a net importer of LPG. So if you remember, sometimes in December, the likes of Central Energy Fund and WASA introduced a new port facility that will be in, importing LPG, which is most likely to double, if not more than double, the capacity of our import in the country. So that is, hopefully that project goes on without glitches and it comes to commission as it is intended. But also we need our rail network to work. We need to have access to rail network that can deliver product first to South African within from our coast into the inland. We need storage facilities, big storage facilities that can carry that product load from the rail network and for use in the inland market. Then we can then start going out. We know our rail network can go as far as Botswana, Zimbabwe, and we need that to work for us to say, as a country, infrastructure-wise, we are ready, we can do this.
Are you encouraged by the progress that Transnet says it's making, or do you still think there are problems in that respect?
I'm an optimist, Dr. Jeremy, and I'm encouraged. I would like to always see the glass full, not half full. I'm encouraged that there is development that is happening. I'm encouraged that the industry itself is making the headway. Transnet is not working alone. They're working with Petredec in that initiative, but also there's other players who are doing more work, and I think they will announce the developments that they're doing with Transnet and with regards to infrastructure soon after this engagement. So I am encouraged that we are going further, we are going forward, we are not standing still.
Infrastructure is one thing, but policy is also important. Do you think it's moving fast enough, or do you think regulation is still one of the bigger brakes on growth in your sector?
Definitely regulation is one of those areas that are putting a brake into the growth of the industry. We have two regulations that are pending, regulations that are possibly going to be the highlight of the industry or of the sector, or at least the single drivers of the sector growth. And if those regulations are not published fast enough, which is the pressure equipment regulations under the Department of Employment and Labor, and the recently announced petroleum product bill that is meant to introduce the regulations on LPG from the Department of Minerals and Petroleum Resources, we need those regulations to move, and to move fast, so that they can start unlocking potential investment that we see as an association in the country.
Let me ask you this. How vulnerable is the LPG supply chain to external shocks, particularly Middle East tensions and shipping disruptions?
As a net importer, we will always be vulnerable to those shocks. We are dependent. We don't have our own resources. We do not have strategic stocks to talk about. So we will always be vulnerable to any shock that happened globally. Though our LPG, majority of our LPG comes from the US, our pricing is based in the Middle East. So that combination alone is to tell you that we'll either suffer the price shock, or we'll suffer at some point the supply shocks. So, or it can happen both, as we know it can happen as the industry grows. So we are extremely vulnerable, and because we are a net importer.
And that's the real problem, because if global supply tightens, and there's every indication that it will, it does expose weakness in building a regional strategy on imported energy, doesn't it?
It does. It does. And hence we need good policies to guide issues of strategic stocks. We need investment to guide issues of strategic stock. But if the government, for example, does not unlock that regulations, does not implement, does not monitor all that regulations once implemented, we stand the chance to say 10 years later, clean cooking did not happen. And because we're trying to make excuses of why it did not happen.
How much pressure are you putting on government right now in that respect?
We are trying as much as we can as an association and our partners to put pressure on the government. If you think about it, they are positioning LPG as a source of energy or a fuel to address issues of clean cooking, which is something that many South Africans do not believe that exists in this country. So it is important when government put policies or talk about issues of clean cooking or mention words like clean cooking, they also do their part, which is regulation, unlocking regulation on the other side.
Thank you very much indeed. In conversation there with Kgadibolai Dihlabi, Managing Director of the Liquefied Petroleum Gas Association in South Africa.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, here's something that we haven't discussed on the program before. I'm told that trail running is booming globally, and here in South Africa, it's increasingly being positioned as more than a sport, but as a tool for economic development, for conservation and rural upliftment. But I guess the real question here is whether events like this genuinely deliver lasting value or simply create short-term spikes in activity. Well, someone who's well positioned to answer that is Michael Edwards, Marketing and Sponsorship Lead at RMB. And let's discuss whether events like the RMB Ultra Trail Drakensberg are meaningful economic drivers or maybe just well-packaged experiences. Michael, first of all, before we talk about the impact and the consequences, why do you think trail running is finding, and if you'll excuse the pun, this traction?
Yeah, Jeremy, thanks so much for having me. And I think there's a number of reasons. I think part of it is certainly off the back of COVID, the COVID era, where people were looking for, not really looking so much as absolutely desperate to get back outdoors and get back out to spaces that are so novel and new experiences, and finding ways to push their limits in the incredible environment heritage that we have here in South Africa. I think it's a global phenomenon. Absolutely, it's booming. The growth is upwards of 200% globally. That's participation. And in South Africa alone, the growth of trail running is over 15%. And I think, like I said, it's people wanting to push their limits. It's people finding a niche sport that is as much about performance as it is about experience and seeing new parts of the country. And I think all of that is just contributed to the growth in South Africa, but globally too.
All well and good, but do you think we might be overstating the economic impact of events like this on rural communities?
I don't think so. And there's a few reasons for that. I think there's certainly an immediate and direct impact of an event like RMB Ultra Trail Drakensberg. That is your usual suspects of travel, accommodation, suppliers, etc. from the region. But more than that, there's an incredible knock-on effect for adventure seekers beyond the event itself, which in itself operates for 3 or 4 days, excluding setup. And I think the RMB Ultra Trail Drakensberg, the event, is a contributor directly, but indirectly, what it becomes is a poster child, and there's a massive media machine behind RMB Ultra Trail Drakensberg that becomes an incredible advertising platform for the region. Whether that's in the Drakensberg or wherever you are in the country or on the continent, it acts as an incredible advert of attraction for people to come and participate. I think big brands and like ourselves, R&B, is getting involved in these events as a signal of credibility and trust. Then you get other brands involved, and it seems to snowball from there with most trail running events. And then beyond the traditional definition of economic impact, there's the economic importance of the bearded vulture and other species in the region. But the bearded vulture is one in particular that we get behind, and together with the Wildlife Act and Isimvelo KZN Wildlife, we, together with the event organizers, have been for years contributing to the preservation of what is a critically endangered species. And it's very difficult to put a value on protection of the species. But like I said, in summary, it just really, for me, it becomes a poster child of what's possible in the region.
Providing, of course, Michael, you strike a very fine ecological balance there. There's always the danger, the risk, that increased tourism actually damages the very environment that you're trying to protect.
100%. It's a very valid point. And I think what we do is we lean very heavily into the promotion and the storytelling that sits behind the preservation of these iconic environmental heritage spaces that we have, as well as the species to which they are home. And I think we invest just as much into that storytelling as we do our association and the building of the event. And to your point, yes, we want the event to go. We want more runners. I think naturally, trail runners are very environmentally conscious people, and I think we lean into that. And I think it's absolutely critical that we're acutely aware that this is a fragile ecosystem, and we deliver the event and we deliver our activation of the event in such a way that absolutely respect that. I think that has to be first and foremost. I think we have some of the most incredible places in this country, and the Drakensberg is one of those. And we definitely don't want to disturb that ecosystem in any way. So it's very important that there's a huge education piece that sits behind this, and that we are 100% in a very environmentally friendly race, and in fact, proactively supporting all that ecosystem.
I just want to come back to community impact, if I can. Beyond race weekend, have you crunched the numbers in terms of what actually stays behind in the local economy? And I'm sure you've done some work on permanent jobs versus temporary event-driven income.
Yeah, absolutely. So I won't go so far as to say that I've crunched the numbers, but anecdotally, we see certainly on the beneficiary front, so that being Wildlife Act and Isimvelo KZN Wildlife, there's definitely some permanent job creation. I think the hospitality industry, certainly with an event like RMB Ultra Trail Drakensberg, what happens is, and this again to the very first question you asked, to the point of the explosion of this sport and how much more people are getting involved, is you get lots of smaller ancillary events coming up about it or growing because of it. And there were events before RMB Ultra Trail Drakensberg, and there will be after, but those other events that sit at other pockets throughout the year generate the same, albeit at a different scale, generate the same hospitality, tourism impact, job creation, usage of local suppliers and partners. So I do think that there is both, like I said up front, there's an immediate return, but there's also a knock-on effect with an event like RMB Ultra Trail Drakensberg.
Michael Edwards, thank you very much indeed. Marketing sponsorship lead at RMB. Appreciate your time. Thank you. And that is our program for today. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We are here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday, or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.